and I loved Jews. Yes, I love them so much. From the towers of New York to the Wailing Wall that they touch. From Ben Shapiro's eyebrows to his sister's giant tits. I love the chosen people, just adore them to bits. Oy vey, oy vey, oy vey, oy vey, oy vey. I love the chosen people, hee dee hip hip hooray. You never should forget that Walt's a friend of the Jews. And if you stand against them, then you're going to lose. Oy vey, oy vey, oy vey, oy vey, oy vey. I love the chosen people, hee dee hip hip hooray. You never should forget that Walt's a friend of the Jews. And if you stand against them, then you're going to lose. I love them so much. From the towers of New York to the Wailing Wall that they touch. From Ben Shapiro's eyebrows to his sister's giant tits. I love the chosen people, just adore them to bits. Oy vey, oy vey, oy vey, oy vey, oy vey. I love the chosen people, eenie hip hip hooray. You never should forget that Walt's a friend of the Jews. And if you stand against them, then you're going to lose.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Radio Tortuga. Today we have, once more, my good Jewish friend, Robert Stark. Robert, how's it going?
Great, Walt. Thanks for having me on. Oy vey, oy vey. You don't want to miss the knowledge and wisdom.
How'd it go? It won't dismiss?
Come gather around, my friend.
I tell
for you about the podcaster who's known so well. Well, Bismarck's the name. A friend of the Jews, oy vey, oy vey.
See, the funny thing is like, you know, like people are going to associate with me, and it sort of gives me space to like say things that are more anti-Semitic because like I have all these songs about how much I love Jews. It's like it's sort of a hyperbole move you can sort of play. But anyway, yeah, great to have you back. So how things for been? Sorry, my cats are running around. How things been for you in the past few weeks, sir?
Yeah, pretty good. I've been prolific on Substack.
Awesome. So, why don't you use this opportunity to show some articles? What's your favorite of all the things that you've published over the past few weeks?
I want to start with the whole like white guys for Kamala thing. I don't know if you saw that. You saw that the article. I wrote a pretty short article, but yeah. It's interesting kind of the responses because some of the more alt-right people embraced it, but I think the response from more kind of normie conservatives and MAGA. Was like you got the usual Dems are the real racist, but then you also got people who were saying it was actually anti-white because it was saying like whites need to be subservient. But I would say that it's interesting because it's good; it gives whites agency because woke people are saying that they actually say colorblindness is white supremacy because it assumes whiteness is the default. But the question is, are the woke actually right about that?
You know, I feel like the whole like racial aspect of Kamala Harris, like people aren't really tuned in to anyone who's actually worked for somebody like Kamala Harris knows that she's not going to be like that anti-white. Like she relies on white men to like get stuff done, right? It's like when you actually work for somebody like that, it's not actually that bad. It's someone like Hillary who's actually a lot scarier. And I don't know about you, but like for me, like Kamala Harris seems a lot more benign than you know Hillary did in the 2016 campaign, and I guess I'm not even that concerned about her winning. I don't feel like she's going to.
Yeah, I think she could end up being kind of incompetent, but I don't see her as like a dangerous tyrant the way that Hillary Clinton is. I guess right. Some people who are super pro Trump will say that there's a whole machine behind her that's dangerous, but just looking at her in individual, I think you're basically right. And I'm not gonna endorse Kamala Harris, but there is some case like. So you could make an accelerationist case why it'd be better to have her as president just because it would sort of hasten people thinking in more terms of like post-Americanism.
Well, it'd be great for us, right? I mean, our audiences would probably grow like twice as fast as they would under Trump. Not to be so crassly like selfish and cynical about things, but I mean, I do just think, what is Trump really going to do, right? I mean, it's not like, even if he did like all the best stuff from Project 2025, but none of the bad stuff, how much is that really going to have like a lingering effect given the whole like human capital problem? I mean, I guess like I've sort of moved in a direction of like not even caring that much about like the civil service or government or the bureaucracy anymore. It seems to me that like that's not where the right ever is going to have its advantage, right? I mean, like academia and the bureaucracy, like liberals are always going to predominate there because right wingers who are high IQ, they go into like consulting or they go into business, they go into like fields where they'll make money. So it seems to me that if we're going to build at least human capital, we need to be competing in those arenas. And that's where we need to be like putting our focus, right? Is like sort of turning that into a hard institutional power structure, as opposed to like working on like, you know, trying to infiltrate the Department of Commerce or whatever. I mean, it just seems kind of silly.
Yeah. Yeah. I basically agree. I do want to talk more about like white guys for Kamala.
Yeah.
It's interesting because like I remember this complaint that Trump would never acknowledge whiteness. I think maybe he did more recently. He said Trump did recently say he's doing really well with white men. But I remember the whole thing, which really pissed off the alt-right, where he would acknowledge that he said, we have the greatest unemployment for every single group except white men. And I do remember, I think Andrew Yang, I remember that was a big deal where he acknowledged like white people back in like, when was that? Like 2019?
It was 2020, yeah.
I think even Bernie Sanders maybe said the word like working class whites a few times, but Trump, maybe he's had a shift recently, but Trump's always been, I think it's really a lot of it is just his age, but I think woke people are really getting at something when they say assuming that whiteness is just the default, that's white supremacy. But I don't think white people are it denies white people agency. So I think ironically, it's like, are you familiar with that meme? The woke are more correct than the mainstream.
Yeah. Oh, they absolutely are, right? Because like there is a sense in which the whole like Dems are real racist is sort of true. I mean, not in the way that stupid Republicans think, but it is true in the sense that like that is a sort of like white man's burden attitude, right? And that they have, and a lot of I mean, the very first or the second, I guess, podcast guest I had on this publication was a black woman, a you know, fairly left wing, who her attitude was like white liberals are more racist than white conservatives because they're just so patronizing. And there's a lot of like black people who just really do despise how patronizing white liberals are. Now, I mean, that kind of codes as like Dems are real racist and cringe conservative to say, but like it is like sort of true, right?
Oh yeah, for sure.
You know, but yeah, I mean, I think your point about like white dudes for Kamala is sort of interesting because like there is a sense in which, yeah, like if you're on the left, that does give you space to be a white male rhetorically in an interesting way. And it's almost like you can almost, because you're coming at it from a sort of oblique direction, you can almost like do more for the interests of white men, like within that framework than you can within the Republican framework, where it's like, you can like dog whistle really harshly against like, you know, thugs or illegals. But it's like, I mean, what does that really get you?
Yeah. Or also like multiculturalism that includes whiteness is better than just American civic nationalism.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like there's a sense in which, I mean, like, do you think Kamala Harris would really be opposed to like a patchwork America where like white guys were talking about being white guys? And like,
I think she just cares about power. But yeah. The question is, would the left and the Democratic Party, would they allow for that? I mean, you had kind of like, I think whiteness is maybe different than saying like specific, but you had like Irish American caucuses within the Democratic Party, and that was perfectly fine. So that's I really don't know like what this kind of multiculturalism that includes whiteness, whether the left will allow for it at some point, or you could see it emerging from the right. I can just pontificate, but.
Well, yeah, this is why I wrote that article about the pro-white case for reparations, right? Because it's like in order to be sort of consciously like a white qua white in American, you know, within the Overton window, like you sort of need to like hedge it in something or couch it in something like sort of antithetical to whiteness. And that's why I think the strongest thing you could do is be pro-reparations, but you do it in a sort of pro-white way. And that sort of squares the circle, unless you can triangulate and get above the terms of debate, right? And you can actually be authentically pro-white in a really robust way. Now, a lot of people didn't like that, but I think that's, you know, like you need to take those sort of approaches if you're going to like have any sort of mainstream political clout.
Do you have any thoughts on appealing to elite human capital? Or I guess before I get to that, is there anything else you'd like to add about just white identity politics and its role in multiculturalism?
No, I mean, I guess I'll just say that I've sort of, you know, I came back to Substack and like I did this big grandiose article of why I'm no longer a white nationalist, but you know, plenty of people have said, like, oh, you're basically a white nationalist. And some people, you know, like, but then a lot of white nationalists hate me because I'm not, like, white nationalist enough. And it's like, I don't know, like, to some extent, I think that we've almost just moved past, like, the need for those categories. And it's like, yeah, like, I care about white interests, but it's not the only thing I care about. And it's something I think we should talk about, just not all the time. And, you know, I think it's almost just, like, become a boring, very, like, normal aspect of American politics. I mean, at least in our circles. I mean, I think that it's almost like in our circles, it's sort of passe, and we've sort of, like, you know what I mean? Like maybe in mainstream politics, it's a little spicy, but I don't feel like, I don't know. Like, I feel like, I don't feel like I'm going to get, like, canceled. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not worried about that.
Because you do have these kind of, like, these conservative, grifty conservative figures who are regurgitating, like, alt-right talking points from, like, 2016 now.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like Matt Walsh and Charlie Kirk. I mean, they're like basically soft white nationalists. I mean, yes.
You just use the term in your article, why you're not a white nationalist, soft white nationalism. Yeah. That's basically like American Renaissance and people who don't desire an ethno state, but they want to keep America maybe like majority white. That's what that is.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, but like, I would say, just more broadly speaking, it's anyone who sort of just advocates for like white interests as a collective, right? Or like who like talk about like, you know, like I'm not ashamed to be white, or like, you know, like the interests of white men. I mean, like, you know, like Matt Walsh and Charlie Kirk are talking like that now, right? In a way they wouldn't. I mean, Charlie Kirk like went to war with Nick Fuentes over this kind of shit in 2019. So I mean, the fact that we've moved to this point, I mean, it's almost like boring on some level, right? It's almost like like part of the reason I'm still sort of a sort of white nationalist coded figure is almost because I sort of want to like sublimate the white nationalist energy and bring it in a more productive direction. You know, like I sort of feel like there's too much like a victim mindset you see in some of my white nationalists. Like they're too like, you know, they're just like blaming everyone, whether it's Jews or Indians or like whatever. Like they're just not agentic. They're not like capable of building anything.
That's the word. Agentic. Yeah, that's like I think it used to be Faustian. Like Faustian was your word, and now agentic is your new word. That's important.
Yeah,
but it is important to be agentic.
Well, yeah, the reason it's important to me is because I'm someone who's naturally very prone to addiction and prone to like compulsive behavior. So, like, it's something I think about a lot. Is like I don't just assume everyone has free will. Like I think it's something you have to like very consciously cultivate. Like to the extent we do have free will, it's something that has to be trained like constantly.
So you're basically a vitalist.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know. Yeah, I guess I would. I mean, that was my original moniker when I came back to Substack, right? I was the vitalist, and then I went back to Walt Bismarck. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I didn't know that had any like ties to BAP because I never read BAP. When I came back, I was calling myself a vitalist, but I didn't know it had that connection. So I'm not a big fan of BAP. I mean, I'm sort of adjacent in some ways, but I go in a completely different direction with it. And
I think you said you take some issue with BAP as far as his importance he places on male aesthetics.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess what I mean by that is like, it's not that like, you know, guys would be ugly or whatever. It's just that like the fixating on like male beauty or whatever is just like very, like men are not going to be able to like compete in those dimensions like women can, right? I mean, like there's just, like most guys are like a 5 or a 6 and then like, we're not supposed to be anything different from that, right? Like that's not supposed to, like, it's very unhealthy to sort of like form your self-concept and your self-esteem around like your physique. And, you know, I think you've got a lot of like Zoomer guys going on steroids at a really young age, you know, because they have these, I mean, it's the whole body image issue thing, right? I mean, it's the same thing like women dealt with in the 90s. You know, you get these guys with like perfect, like six packs on Instagram or whatever. And you get a lot of like young guys wanting to go and test. And I don't know. I think it's, I mean, obviously like anything that moves directionally in the favor of testosterone is probably good. But I mean, I don't like the fact that it's sort of like warped everyone's self-concept, because to me it's just very like homoerotic, right? The idea of like valuing men for their bodies like is an aesthetic thing as opposed to like a function, you know.
What are your thoughts on the whole thing of calling JD Vance weird from the Kamala campaign and sort of an attack on social status? And do you think, what are your thoughts like on that and just like how important social status is weaponized in politics?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. Like JD Vance is weird, right? Like he does have a sort of like incel energy, and I sort of relate to him in the sense that I have kind of a common background with him. It's like being sort of white trash and then like sort of like matriculating into the elite classes, but like feeling like you're really not part of either, right? Like you're not really, you know.
Well, he's this weird hybrid because he's not really, he's too assimilated to be like a hillbilly, but at the same time, he's not like fully assimilated. He's in this weird in between kind of stage, and it comes across as like really awkward.
No, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's how I feel a lot of times, right? Because I'm too trashy for like upper middle class people. But then if I go back to my trashy family, they think of me as like a weird, like a feet faggot or something. You know what I mean? It's sort of
that. You said you didn't really connect with the normie white people in like Nebraska.
No, not at all. No. So, I mean, I understand like where Vance is sort of coming from. Like, I think he's somebody who's never really felt, I mean, if you read his book, like you can tell he's like manicuring it and like he's probably like covering up a lot of like weird shit he did as a kid. It's very like, obvious.
Even though
like,
the couch, the whole having sex with the couch thing is fake, but there is something, there are things about him that are kind of weird.
Yeah. I mean, like, he did do weird shit, right? But like he obviously was, manicuring his own image, and you know, it's to be expected. But I mean, like, there clearly is like a vibe there that people are picking up on. And I guess like the left is, I think they're overplaying their hand because it's there is an extent to which like the right
well,
has.
They're the ones. I guess this is like the basic bitch kind of conservative response. But the conservatives will say they'll post like images of like the left having all this like trans stuff and saying, "Look, right. Look, you're the ones who are really weird," and it's kind of. It's kind of petty, but it is weird about how the politics, how the left sort of like they utilize being weird and being transgressive, but then they also switch things around and present themselves as the party of normalcy.
Well, I mean, that's a recent development.
It is actually, I think it can be an effective strategy to play both sides, and the right could do it too.
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is like I think that's a recent development, right? I think it's a function of. Like the whole like emphasis on normalcy that's always been a Republican thing. I mean, forever. Like the Republican Party's been the party of like the sort of core Americans, like normal Americans. Whereas the Democrats were like the coalition of the fringes, be they minorities or feminists or gays or whatever, right? And you know, it used to be like ethnic, like the white ethnics, and you know, now it's like racial minorities. But it's always been like Democrats were weird. Right. And that would include like nerds and like social rejects and stuff. And like,
well,
80s
yeah,
and 90s.
That's another thing. I think nerds used to be like white male nerds in the Reagan era. They sort of leaned to the left. And then there was a huge pivot of like white male nerds to the right for obvious reasons.
Well, yeah, it depends on what you mean by nerd, right? Because you obviously have like the Funko Pop, like Redditor type who's always been left. But like,
oh,
that's
right.
Usually a real nerd. Like, it's the sort of people who like guys like us, right? Like, we obviously like move to the right.
The alt right, it was kind of a queer movement.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, yeah, I agree. And I guess what my point is, though, is that like the Democrat Party has become the party of like bourgeois middle class sensibilities, right? Of normalcy, of
right.
Being like, you know, whereas the Republican Party is now like the party of like weird, it's like the Hawk to a girl. Right. And it's like it's going to be like kind of trashy sort of behavior. And that's why I think the Barstool impulse is going to be very necessary, because the Republican Party isn't going to be like the party like the Democrats are going to be more sexually restrained now than the Republicans. I think the Hawk to a girl is a sort of like premonition of that. Right. Because I think that like Democrats are going to be the ones who say, like, don't talk about sex in public. That's like, you know, you're imposing your fetishes on people. That's like sexual. Like they'll use leftist language, but it'll be very puritanical, whereas the right will be the ones who are like, you know, willing to talk about like sex in public. So I think it's going to be like a total shift in our sensibilities. And you know, 20 years from now, it's going to be completely unrecognizable compared to when we were kids.
Do you have thoughts on strategies? Oh, I guess I want to get your thoughts, like your thoughts on the whole like elite human capital concept.
Yeah.
And how the right has this shortcoming with elite human capital and strategies of becoming more of like a high status movement and building distant elites.
No, I mean, I agree with Hanania's recent take. I think that like, it's basically, and, you know, with tracing wood grains and all them, is, I mean, I think it's sort of baked into the cake. But I think that we need to just pivot, or like we need to build around our strengths. Like, we can't like act like it's like it's just like lost or like the like I don't like how sometimes Hanania will just sort of like cede all the ground to the left or I mean, like he'll sort of like want to own.
I'm not dissing Hanania, but he definitely really likes to signal, which I get.
Yeah, I mean, I hate like right wing judge too, but he like counter signals them like all the time, to the extent where he's just like, you know, I mean, it's funny, like poor John Arcto just is totally like terrorized by him. But yeah, no, I guess my thing is like elite human capital is obviously important, but I don't think we need to be building that in academia or journalism or, you know, government bureaucracies. I don't think that matters as much. I think that, you know, the private sector is where the right has always been strong.
But there's sort of like a Brahmin versus Vaishya archetype, and like the right tends to be more like Vaishya, more mercantile. And I think for people who are like right wing people who are more Brahmin, and less, I think like including like artists and people interested in academia and philosophy, like they can be like really screwed.
Okay,
well, they don't really have a niche.
Here's my big brain take for you is that the whole Brahmin versus Vaishya dynamic is based off of a sort of pre-industrial or even industrial sort of economic script. And when you get into the modern like symbol manipulation economy, it's the Brahmin priestly caste that can become the most economically successful. And in fact, that's what's happened. If you look at like Silicon Valley and stuff, it's the white Brahmins who are the ones who are dominating there. It's not really, it's not Vaishya types in Silicon Valley, right? So
like Vaishya types are more like they're running like auto dealerships.
Yeah. Like Vaishyas aren't going to like job stack. Right. I mean, like maybe some of them will as like followers, but like the people who start job stacking, like people who even like come up with this, right. Like I'm obviously like a Brahmin sort of person, right? I mean, it's artisan.
Obviously, it's been around for a while. Would you say are you having a role in really pioneering it, or you'd say other people?
No. So yeah, obviously it's been around for a while. Like you have that guy J. Rolf Holzer or whatever on Twitter.
Oh right.
Like, yeah, he's the main one. But I'd say that what I've done is I've created like an aesthetic for it.
Oh, like as a patronage network for your people.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So I'm giving it like a long-term trajectory that's like out of job stacking itself. But then more broadly, I'm giving it like a sort of moral or ethical or even just like artistic and aesthetic sort of foundation that makes it like more than just about like being greedy. And like, you know, the idea is like you're like doing it for pro-social ends. And more than that, like even to the extent you are doing it for, you know, because you're greed or plunder or whatever, it's like it's something you're doing with your bros. It's like you're having fun being a pirate. And there's a whole like LARPy aspect to it, which I think is like...
Your brand is all like everything's been rebranded with the pirate theme.
Well, yeah, I mean, like if you remember like Walt Bismarck stuff from 2016, I feel like there's a certain similar energy with the pirate stuff, right? I mean, it's sort of like very like Disney pirates. I mean, it's very self-consciously LARPy.
It's camp.
Like, Yeah. But it's like when you lean into it enough, it's like everyone just kind of, especially as millennials, right? Like, we'll just, I feel like most of the guys in my group are millennials and like, we'll just embrace that a little bit more readily than Zoomers or Gen X will.
Oh yeah. That's another thing. I think millennials are more camp and much more into nostalgia.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know like how I describe Zoomers are kind of, they're much more deracinated and cut off from the past.
Zoomers like want to be camp though. Like I think that there's this energy. They like want to let loose and be free and like just like be silly, but like they're afraid of being called cringe. But when a millennial comes around and is like cringe or around a Zoomer in like a charismatic way, the Zoomers will go along with it, right? And then the Gen Xers hate that because the Gen Xers want the Zoomers to be all detached and like irony bro like them, right? But then really it was this millennials who were meant to lead Gen Z, not Gen X, right? I mean, like Gen X is just kind of like what are they doing? like they're kind of just like purposeless. Like they never were able to seize power from the boomers in any meaningful way. And like they're a very pathetic sort of generation. You know. So well, you're a millennial, not Gen X, right?
I'm millennial, right?
Okay, good.
Do you think it's viable of appealing to people within like the existing elite? Because I think you're not really a populist, but by its nature, it's really failured in that been a failure, but. Do you think you've been reaching out, getting your message out to people from elite backgrounds, and how effective do you think it is?
No. Yeah, I think that there's certain like heterodox kind of centrist sort of people who will be drawn to a like a right wing vitalist, you know, high openness movement just because it's so novel and bizarre to them. And then they'll sort of get drawn into your culture. And then by osmosis, they'll sort of become like, you know, like more pro-white or more, you know, like anti-feminist or whatever than they otherwise would have been. And I think I've certainly seen that in my social circle here on Substack. So I think it's possible, but like these are exceptional people, right? Like, I mean, I did a poll in my community and they were all like 90th percentile openness. You know, like people who are anywhere, even someone who's like 80th percentile openness, like they tend to find me like kind of weird and off-putting or just, I don't know. So I don't even know if it's like a left-right thing because like, if anything, like right-wingers seem to hate me more than left-wingers. So I don't even know if it's that so much as like,
It's like neurotribalism, like your psychological profile sometimes trumps politics.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I'm temperamentally that liberal, but I'm sort of like, there's like the gray tribe terminology, you know, like right, guys right. Like us are kind of, you know, I don't know, like spiritually libertarian, what you'd call it. But
what do you make of the whole like right wing of the center right of the Silicon Valley, like Musk, Thiel, Sachs, and Andreessen? I think have you been reading some of like Rachel Haywire's commentary about them, about how she said they used to be like more, I'm not sure who she's talking about in particular, but how they used to be more like censorious, and your thoughts on that whole scene in general.
I think they're just, obviously like it wasn't as politically charged in the past, and like tech was more just coded as left because, you think about like what were the political forces in the country at the time? It was probably like the Tea Party, right? Which was very much like a middle American sort of like car dealership sort of impulse. There weren't a lot of like, tech bros in the Tea Party. Whereas these days, you see like Catholic integralists among tech bros, like you'll see like, the neo-reaction types. I mean, like all sorts of dissident right sort of people. I mean, it's more of a prominent thing. So like, I mean, it's sort of just like the right's become weirder, right? I think it's probably in part like just a natural coalitional reaction of the left becoming more the party of like suburban like bourgeois sensibilities. And like as the right becomes weirder, then yeah, like tech is going to become more of a right wing sort of scene, especially because like the left wing in this country has been just very, a lot of it is just like left wing journalists are very hostile to like tech bros, and a lot of them just resent that. So it sort of like sent them towards the right when they otherwise wouldn't have.
Yeah. So what do you think? So job stacking, it's sort of a practical solution to fight against corrupt institutions. And I bring up kind of like the termite theory where you sort of become a termite on society, but more on, it could be a negative connotation, but it could also be against corrupt institutions.
Right.
But yeah. How would you just like, you've talked about job stacking, like the logistics of it, but what would you say about the whole like political and philosophical angle of it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Against like a lot of the slave morality about like contributing to society that you would get from like boomer conservatives.
Right. Yeah. If you look at someone like Dave Ramsey, he's very much against job stacking because his whole concept of the economy is stuck in this 20th century sort of industrial paradigm wherein, companies will have loyalty towards you and you're supposed to have loyalty towards the company where, we haven't had massive globalization yet, where we haven't had these mass movements of people and the sort of like decline in social capital and just common trust. I mean, like all of these things have sort of like deteriorated and like the boomers haven't really processed that yet. And they still sort of think we're in that, you get a gold watch in your retirement sort of world. But no, like we have at-will employment in the U.S., which means that they can fire you at any time not for no reason. Like obviously you can sue them, right? If you think that there's like a bad cause, discrimination or something, but in theory they can fire you for any reason, and you can quit for any reason. So neither of you have any obligations morally to the other, and it's all really a sort of cynical power game where you have to game out around the expectation that the other party is going to be as selfish and as cynical as possible. And that's, I've worked as a consultant, like in risk management departments, and like, they game around the expectation of employee selfishness. So they already have like insurance and like all of their sort of like policies, like their short-term disability policy is like sort of like gaming out that there's going to be a certain amount of fraud in there, right? Like it's all priced in. So basically, like we live in a very sort of like overdetermined sort of economy where everything is sort of priced in. And I think that because of that, you need to be doing the best thing for yourself because everyone else who is capable has already priced in like selfishness and that's what they're doing, right? Really, like you're just being a sucker if you're not. Your CEO has absolutely no loyalty to you. And that's even more so the case if you're at like a small business. Because then there's a direct sort of financial, like disincentive for them to care about you. So you just can't, we live in a world where like reputation matters a lot less, where your word isn't as important, where people can just move and they can shed their bad reputation at a moment's notice. So there's much less of an incentive for like powerful people to actually, care about their employees or take, the noblesse oblige doesn't exist anymore. And because of that, you have to game around that and you have to be just as selfish as the corporations are. So that's the basic like moral stance. Also, the fact that HR is like lying to you all the time, right? I mean, HR is completely deceptive to you, and it's trying to like put you in a position where you have as little leverage as possible over the company. So, if you do the same thing by saying you have ADHD and submitting all these like medical things that make it really hard for HR to make any movements against you, I see it as just reciprocity. I mean, like you are in a much weaker position than they are, right? And I don't view it as it seems to be. It's not just slave morality, but it's a very sort of like grotesque kind of slave morality when you're saying that like it's bad when you as the little guy win against the big guy, but you know, like when the shoe's on the other foot, then like, you have to do what they say, right? Because it's like their morality is on top. Like it's sort of might makes right only when the strong are in charge. But whenever the weak sort of like destabilize things, then might no longer makes right. Like to me, that's just completely grotesque. And that's what I'm sort of like pushing back against. So I guess that's how I generally see it. And now in terms of like, is job stacking like good for society? I mean, obviously it's indicative of a certain like crisis of competence. You have a lot of these big corporations that have a lot of like bullshit jobs.
I think it would force, I'm not sure how much it can really like undermine these corporate institutions, but it could force, it could expose like corruption and waste and mismanagement and bring up, I think it could bring about either something positive or, but even putting that aside, I think people need to get into a mindset of not thinking about society as a whole. It sounds really selfish and kind of maybe kind of bad, but people should be thinking more about like enriching their own tribe and thinking like who are your people and you should be helping like your people. People sort of need to get more in that mindset. And it's really alien to a lot of Americans.
Well, yeah. Because,
like, middle-class white people.
Well, only middle-class white people. I mean, like every other group. I mean, even like Italians used to have like Italian professional associations. I mean, less so nowadays because they're more assimilated. But like, it's a very sort of waspish sort of thing that like you should be purely meritocratic and not like, you know, rely on sort of covert professional institutions that are for your group. I mean, like obviously Jews and Indians and all these other groups will, you know, like do all sorts of things to sort of collaborate behind the scenes. And I don't, you know, the alt-right sort of hates them for that. I don't blame them. I mean, I think we should, you know, follow in their example. So that's why I support this. But what I was saying, it was like, I mean, I think that there is a sense in which this is proof that there are some very like sort of destructive forces in our economy in terms of waste and mismanagement. As you say, like a lot of these bullshit jobs are just like sinecures for the upper middle class, for like an overproduced elite. It's a sort of like, what's it called?
Oh, so with job stacking, you're actually taking those jobs away from people.
Yeah. And I think it's, I mean, like to me, that's a positive because I'm taking it away from like some bug man who would spend it all on Funko Pops and Marvel movies and you know, weed, you know, as I say, you know, far for the better. But yeah, I mean, like it's proof that there's something very inefficient in our economy that this is sort of allowed to happen, but it's a UBI, right? Like these email jobs are UBIs for the elite. And it's a sort of dirty little secret of our entire economy. So it's like, obviously the most capable people can just collect all the UBIs and get really, I mean, it's entrepreneurialism is what it is, right? I mean, you could say, I mean, the closest thing is probably to piracy, which is why my aesthetic works well. But I mean, I view it as a purely entrepreneurial venture. Like we're sort of capturing all of these like loose like strands of these like vectors of cash that are just like otherwise going to go into some like asshole neckbeard's pocket, right? So it's like, to me, it's a sort of pro-social thing because here's what we're doing, Robert, is we're sort of creating an incentive for these companies to run themselves more efficiently, right? And we are like, it's sort of like you find the pressure points of society and you like stomp on them, and that's sort of it encourages like it's a creative destruction. It encourages like a more now, I mean, yeah, this sounds kind of shitty because obviously I'm doing this for my own personal benefit and the benefit of my tribe. I mean, I won't deny that, but I do think in a broad sense, like the whole like opposition of the con artist is kind of silly because the con artist is like testing.
Or saying how people hate, like people hate on the grifter, but the problem is like with being a grifter, there's nothing like be making money online is the dream. There's nothing wrong with that. But it really like the issue of grifters is the quality of their output. Like if they put out quality output, then there's really no problem. But people can't really even define the term grifter. The issue is like more like the quality of their output.
Well, I mean, it's people who are just like low quality themselves and who can't make anything good who call people grifter. I mean, like I've never met somebody who like produces something good and makes like, I've never seen like a rich person call anyone a grifter, right? I've never seen somebody.
It is like, kind of low. It is low status coded.
Yeah, I mean, like But the problem is like when you ever have like an echo chamber where like everyone has the same power, right? Like everyone's voice is sort of and in a sense, Substack is more like egalitarian than like Twitter or YouTube, right? So in a sense, it's easier to call.
Yeah, like on Substack, once on Substack, there is somewhat more reward for quality. When on Twitter, everything is subject to like the algorithms.
Yeah, but what I mean is, like, Substack has a certain middle-class aspect to it in the sense that, you know, writers and readers can, like, interact very easily. And I think because of that, like, there's a certain, like, leveling effect, right, where, like, there's less of a celebrity. And, you know, somebody might, like, if I, like, a lot of the stuff that I get called a grifter for on Substack, I wonder if I would get called a grifter for that on Twitter because it's sort of just, like, And like there's almost like the Scandinavian aspect of Substack where it's just like everyone is expected to be on the same like level playing field. And like the whole like I've seen a lot of people be like very resentful towards like orange checks, right? Like there's a certain like crabs in the bucket, like Jante Loven aspect where they sort of want to like
that's how much paid subscribers you have.
Yes, correct. But not how much you're making. So I'm making more now, I think, than some people who have like the opaque orange check, or maybe not, I'm not sure. But the point is, because I have a ton of founding subscriptions, like I actually have a much higher like ratio of like money compared to like my number of paid subscribers and a lot of people. Like the New Right Post was actually pointing that out the other day. So I don't know. I mean, like I'm proud of like that's the thing is I hate this like notion that like we should be ashamed to talk about money or we should be ashamed to be like I don't know. I mean, like I guess I do have a certain trashy element. Like I do like to brag about the money I've made. Like I think it's something to be proud of, you know. And I think we'd have a better sort of culture if people were just more willing to do that. But it has such a like stark sort of stark. It has such a like stark like power thing, right? And like in terms of like status or whatever, like it sort of like hits people where it's like with sex, right? It's like
yeah, it's a way. It kind of it doesn't do away with it. It's sort of a slave morality, but it's also a way to mask inequality and wealth.
Yeah, because it's like rich people who don't want to talk about money a lot of times. Well, upper middle class people, like rich people, will like to talk about money, but like upper middle class people hate talking about money. Because like to them, it's like I think the idea is like they know it'll put a target on their head, right? If they start talking about it. So like they try to like avoid it at all costs because like they're
it's
the ones.
It's kind of the same thing with aesthetics of like people who are well off who go for really bland banal aesthetics that downplay their wealth. Or you see, right. Or the same like big tech campuses are often like really, really like low strung and really bland, and they're not at all like opulent like the financial like skyscrapers of like the 80s.
Yeah, I remember I really hated when I first started working, like seeing all these tech bros around me who would like carry their laptop in a backpack, and I was like, why don't you use a briefcase? It just looks so much more masculine and like ornate and powerful or whatever. But like I think there is just that sort of like sloppy like little kid energy that everyone, so like it's supposed to be casual, you're supposed to like not care, it's seen as like having a certain sprezzatura, but I do find it kind of repulsive on some level.
Do you think job stacking, what you're doing, can be a vehicle for setting up like patronage networks to support like creative projects and for your people?
Yeah, I mean that's to me one of the main goals. Like, I guess my problem is like when we think about patronage on the right, it's either people asking like Peter Thiel or Elon Musk for like millions of dollars, or you know, asking everyone and their grandma for like $10, and it's like, you know,
there's
like
nothing, absolutely nothing in between.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, why can't we just have a bunch of like we have like a, because on the left there is, right? Because think about it, like on the left you have a ton of people who make like 400, 500 grand a year who just donate like 20 grand. To some like fucking foundation, but it's stupid like malaria nets and shit like that. It's like effective altruism bullshit. So like we need to cultivate like a class of like a right wing gentry class that can sort of you know, do the same thing and then fund like our shit. Like I mean, just funding. I don't know. Like paying. My good friend Sai, you know, she researches like endocrine disruptors and shit, and like you know, because her research was more like controversial or politically charged, like she had difficulty getting like if we could just like fund enough sort of like dissident or just heterodox sort of thinkers, you know, like, and specifically like you need sort of sophisticated mid-sized investors to do this, because again, like whenever you just get like rich chamber of commerce like millionaire Republicans, it's always they're always going to just donate to like dumb fucking like Tom Sowell, like, you know, like it's always going to be that stupid bullshit.
Right,
Glenn Lowry. What's your background, by the way? Did you have a tech background?
No, I haven't. I've always been in the arts.
Okay. Yeah, well, okay. We talked about this in the first convo. I remember that. Okay.
I think we did.
Yeah. I'm like very sorry. I've been up for like over 40 something hours now. My memory is probably not great.
What do you think about like funding like film projects, like movies?
Yeah. I mean, I'm all for it. I mean, I think it's actually funny. I don't know if I'd say dating, but I was seeing a girl a few weeks ago who's a big like artist girl, like a like filmmaker in the Austin like right wing art scene, and you know, she's like looking for people to like invest in her. I think she's like Minch's Moldbug is a crush on her, so she's trying to get money from him or whatever. But yeah, I mean, like, you know,
I'm
like
involved with a movie project.
Oh, you are?
I don't know if I want to give away the plot because it's in pre-production, but I'm not directing it. I'm just going to be an actor in it.
Oh, that's cool.
But when it's formalized, I'll make like a big announcement and have a show on it when it's when it's, but we're still in really basically pre-production.
How did you guys get funding?
We hardly have any funding.
Yeah, see, that's the one thing I will say is that AI is going to make things a lot easier for a lot of people. I don't know if you're using that at all, but I think that's just like generally speaking, you know, it's going to allow just industrial scale production of like high quality art. I mean, like the sort of songs that I can make with AI, like I could write like a whole like rock opera in like a week. Whereas like back in, you know, it would take me forever to like sing those songs. And I would be
like, Disney songs that you made back in like 2015, how much work did you put into them?
Oh, well, usually I would do like one at a time. Like I would do almost like everything at once, right? And it would take me probably like 12 hours altogether. Because I mean, sometimes like, you know, some of the more shitposty ones, if I was actually trying to sound good, I would like re-record it over and over. Like I'd record each line separately. So I mean, yeah, I mean, it would take pretty long. But like these days, like that job stacking song I did, I didn't like, you know, 2 hours, right? Like we're probably, I mean, honestly, and most of the time, like I wrote the lyrics in like 30 minutes. I was just like refreshing the you know, the curation process to try to get like a good one, a good roll of the dice. So, I mean, I think it's fantastic. Like, do you do any AI art stuff at all?
I haven't, to be honest, I haven't got into it yet, but I really should.
Yeah, it lets you scale up shit so fast and cheaply. You know, but of course, a lot of people hate that about it, right? Because they view it as like more, you know, like there's a certain person who just hates scalability or fungibility. Like they view it as like dehumanizing.
It's good for people who are automation. Well, I think it will benefit people who are creative.
I think it'll benefit like conceptual artists, but it won't benefit like very like craftsman type artists.
Oh, that's true. Do you have thoughts on like what kinds of people will thrive the most, and what kinds of people will really suffer under like mass automation?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm sort of like white-pilled because I think that like the people who are going to do the best are the people who are very volatile and who can kind of like adjust to different environments very quickly and who don't like, you know, who can sort of like burn their darlings very, very easily or kill their darlings pretty easily. And I think it's going to be like people who can, you know, like deal with a very sort of asymmetric sort of world, like the Pareto principle, right? Like to me, the modern economy is like basically predicated on the Pareto principle more than anything else. And like once you just see how pretty much all the value is coming from like a very small piece of the pie in almost any situation, then you just like, I mean, it's sort of empowering in a sense because like, you know, you can sort of like jump on that and you can sort of like capture the, like the source of the value. And then you can, you know, get very rich from that. But it's also sort of intimidating or sort of blackmailing because it's like, if you're not part of that, you know, valuable like piece of the pie, or if you don't have access to it, then like you don't got shit. Right.
With politics, you said that you would reject pluralism now. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, all I meant by that was, you know, I sort of came back to Substack with this whole impulse of like wanting to talk to people from all these different worldviews. And, you know, I met a lot of like really great friends and it was fantastic. I mean, I still value everybody I met. You know, I mean, just some shout outs, obviously, my buddy Rajiv, Ringleader, Crypto Gal, Lirpa, Sai.
I interviewed Rajiv.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Have you posted that one yet? I'm trying to remember if I...
Yeah, that was a few months ago.
Oh, okay. I remember that. Yeah. No, yeah. Rajiv's great. I mean, he's becoming kind of his own, and he's involved in the job stacking thing too. So, I mean, he's fucking awesome. I guess my point is like, I mean, someone like him is like, you know, like completely, I don't want to say politically homeless, but I mean, he's not really like right wing, but he sort of affiliates with us because it's sort of like, you know, like it's really the only place that makes sense for him. Even though he's like a gay brown guy, just sort of like, you know, like he's sort of kind of disgusted with like the aspects of the left that it just makes a lot more sense to sort of be on our side. So, I mean, you know, like people like that, I couldn't have met if I hadn't done the pluralist impulse. So I don't regret it in any sense. But what I will say is that I started coming up against like Muslims and Tradcats and people from communities that are very sort of cohesive and very intransigent and very sort of disciplined. And they sort of march in lockstep with one another. And I mean, like they'll just wage jihad against you. And you can't be a pluralist leader, you know, fighting against jihad. I mean, you're really not even a leader. You're like a zookeeper. Right. Like you brought all these elephants and hyenas and shit. And then, you know, like once the zookeeper goes down, I mean, they'll just all go out of their cage and run in different directions. They're not going to come like defend the zookeeper. Right. So I think that's sort of what happened. That's not to say that like my friends were like obligated to all like come side with me against the trackers or Muslims. I mean, you know, whatever. But it's more just like, you know, if I'm going to be like, I realize that I'm sort of an asshole. I'm sort of like a disagreeable sort of person, and like, you know, I cause strong reactions in people, and I'm going to get a lot of people sort of like coalescing against me. And I think you know, it makes sense to have a more unified sort of coalition you're leading if you're going to be in that sort of situation, right? I mean, like to stand up against jihad, you need like sort of your own jihad. And I mean, I don't know, like putting hundreds of thousands of dollars in guys' pockets, it's a pretty good way to like inspire loyalty and inspire a sense of cohesion that'll sort of like get everyone on the same page to like pursue our collective interests as specifically like the whole like thing I'm kind of going for here with Tortuga. I mean, it is pluralist. Like it's not like we're like banning like Tradcasts or anything from our organization. However, like ultimately like the sort of like ethos that we have is sort of like white male, upper middle class atheist in like a city.
Should you have an estimate of like the class demographic breakdown of your fans and followers?
I mean, I'm sure it's overall very pluralist. I'd say that the guy in Bizbuck, or not Bizbuck, now it's Tortuga, I'd say they're, you know, quite similar to me, it seems. I mean, some of them, you know, like they're, like a lot of them are just like computer programmers or data people or whatever.
Do you think the current scene is more upper middle class than previous iterations of the dissident right?
I think that like the people that I in particular am interacting with on Substack, which aren't all dissident right. I mean, a lot of them come from like, you know, the Scott Alexander's, you know, rationalist.
Sort of some libertarian, some gray tribe centrism.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say I'm sort of just like mean gray tribe. Right. I feel like all the mean gray tribe people gravitate to, but I feel like I'm sort of like, yeah, I don't know. Like, I think both red tribe and blue tribe people would sort of, I mean, I think red tribe people would hate me more and blue tribe people just wouldn't even acknowledge that I exist.
Does it serve a meta political purpose to talk about how society or politics should ideally be, or do you think it's too much of a cope and a distraction?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'm sort of, I guess, like inclined to say that, yeah, it is a cope and a distraction that it's, I mean, it's weird. I was like a philosophy major. I'm a very contemplative person, but there's part of me that my impulse now is just like, fuck it. Like we should just make as much money as possible, build as much power as possible, and then disregard like questions of morality or philosophy or whatever. Because it's sort of just like, who the fuck cares? Like until you have the power.
Also coming up with policy proposals too.
Yeah. I mean, policy proposals though, it's sort of like, it's like the most important thing is that you seize control of the state. I mean, but even then, I mean, it's like, you know, like it could just get overturned in an election. I mean, if I found out anything, Rob, it said that just like having money and being able to sort of into like, it's sort of like not 100%, because you can sort of just like not follow the rules. Right. And like, you can sort of just make your own rules if you have enough money, and you can sort of just like define how things are going to be in your own little bubble, your own little like rarefied, you know, bubble. And I think that should be the goal for individual guys is if you want to get free, don't just like focus on like electing Ron Paul or whatever. I mean, like if you want to be free, you just make money and then you can sort of like bribe people as you need to, you know, do what you say and, you know, just kind of create that little zone for yourself. I mean, to me, that's just a lot more effective in practice.
Do you have thoughts on the whole controversy about Vance where he said about his comment on childless cat ladies and how the left got really morally outraged by that, but then also, do you think it's stupid to call out your political adversaries for not reproducing?
Yeah, because I wrote an article about this where I was saying, you know, like most people who don't have kids, like who are, you know, like 35 or whatever, it's not that they like don't want to, it's just that you haven't met the right person yet. And if you're like a secular person in like an urban environment,
what it does, it does really hit people on a really visceral level.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, people who are, like, been in the suburbs their entire life, like, look, I think the thing, there's part of, like, a status jockeying thing here, right, where it's, like, somebody who, like, if you're, like, a two-income couple where you, like, together you make, like, 70 grand and you're in the suburbs and you have, like, four kids and, like, you know, you don't have a very high standard of living and, like, you know, the wife is kind of chubby while running around covering puke all the time, like, you sort of need to feel like you're better than the dinks who are, like, attractive and skinny and, like, glamorous or whatever. Otherwise, it's, like, what do you have, right? So you sort of need to, like, superciliously say, like, oh, you guys aren't, you know, procreative, so you're, like, scum. And I think that that's sort of the implicit dynamic is because dinks are just so much higher in social class. And you know, they get to enjoy more vacations and really, I mean, like we don't talk about this, there's a sense in which like, you know, you have these dink couples that are making like 400 grand together that are like bidding up all these homes and all these vacation prices and shit. And it's sort of like putting pressure on like single income families or even just normal middle-class, you know, like dual income families in the heartland. And they're not able to like go to Disney World or whatever anymore because it's too fucking expensive. So, I mean, I think there is that sort of like economic rivalry or competition that sort of begets, a sort of cultural like status jockey.
Well, there's a U-shaped trend in fertility. So it's highest among the poor, but it's higher among the fertility is higher among the wealthy than the middle class. So I think of the dinks as maybe being like the upper middle class, but fertility might be higher among like the ultra wealthy.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're making millions, then yeah, like a lot of those guys, you know, I mean, first off, a lot of those guys probably have like secret families, right? But like, I mean, yeah, I mean, like a lot of those, like Elon Musk has 12 kids or whatever, right? Because he just has all these concubines all over the place. Yeah, I mean, because the U-shaped distribution exists in a lot of things, right? If you look at like cars, right? Like rich guys and poor guys will both drive red cars. Middle class guys will never drive a fucking red car.
They all have like white or gray Teslas.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's the upper middle class that's the worst. They're the most, they have like the least like gender differentiation, right? They're the most like men and women sort of like act the same. And it's sort of seen as like very barbaric to have like gendered behavioral norms. And that's why, like, personally, I just cannot fit in with the upper middle class at all, even though that's like sort of my like people I swim in. I have a sort of like trashy ethos where I have extreme like gendered views on behavior and like just sort of, you know, like talking about money openly, talking about sex openly. I mean, these are things that rich people will do or poor people will do, but like upper middle class people will never do. And they despise you if you do it because it really, you know, like it's sort of a, they're afraid that it could sort of like beget a sort of like a descent back into like the working class, right? Like that, which is their biggest fear. So, you know, they view it as just inherently barbaric and they'll very much punish you for indulging in that behavior. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a weird sort of thing, but I guess what I will say is that I do sort of, like, it's not that I identify with the dinks because I would theoretically like to have kids one day, but I do sort of think that like the right wing puts too much of an emphasis on procreation just because, like biomedical technology. I mean, like, you know, you're gonna have stuff like life extension technology is going to be like people living to like 200. I mean, like you're going to have like CRISPR, you're going to have all these artificial wombs. I mean, like, I think that the whole landscape is going to so radically change in 20, 30 years that like all of the like pronatalist, you know, obsessions of the right, it's going to seem like retarded.
Also, like with the whole like natalist obsession of the right, do you think it should be more selective as opposed to for everyone? Like a lot of like right wing politicians are proposing that kind of policy.
What do you mean? Like, could you elaborate?
Yeah. So they're like proposing things like handing out money or tax incentives for each kid.
Well, we already do that, right? We have the child tax credit, so it's like, you know.
Do you think that automation is going to create, like, major Darwinian bottlenecks?
I think that, I don't even know if it's automation so much as, like, dopamine traps, which, I mean, it's going to play into automation, right? Because obviously, like, you know, if you have, like, AI-generated, like, video games or porn, it's going to be just more, like, hyper-salient. But, like, I think that, like, you know, the dopamine trap, like, that's why I'm kind of a vitalist. It's And again, I mean, I'm someone who struggles with addiction and compulsive behavior. So for me, it's just something I think about constantly. Just the fact that, I don't know, there's something like TikTok, right? Like the human, like really, it's just insanely maladaptive that we just allow this in our civilization. Or I mean, even something like
Twitter, I find Twitter to be like really addictive and it drains, it's a big waste of time. Like I multitask while I'm writing Substack articles, but it's still a big waste of time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, just imagine what it would have been like to be like Leonardo da Vinci or Ben Franklin. I mean, it like you can see why they were able to invent so much shit because it's like they're not being distracted by like all this really fun, like hyper addictive Skinner boxes all the time, right? I mean, so yeah, I mean, I just don't think it's I don't know if I would say we should ban it, but I mean, like to me, I was actually talking to Rachel Haywire about this. Like I was saying that like I think the only thing that for me has ever gotten me to overcome my addiction or my compulsive behavior is to become like more compulsive or more addicted to something that's actually like positive. So for instance, if I'm getting too fat, like instead of having a food addiction, I'll be like addicted to like walking. I don't know. Or like recently, right? Like instead of being addicted to like content, like, you know, I'll be addicted to making content, right? And like, if you're addicted to creativity or generativity, then you're sort of benefiting from it at least in a lot of ways. Whereas, I mean, you're also creating things that other people will consume. So maybe it's sort of a feedback loop. But I mean, at the very least, like you're sort of escaping from it. So, I mean, I think that really production and generativity is the one escape from dopamine traps that is, you know, available to us.
Are you familiar with like breeder selection theory where, well, society has all these antinatalist selection pressures, the people who are more genetically selected for fertility will end up becoming more demographically pronounced in the future. And you also see like these new, like different like social and class groups and even political groups forming these new ethnogenesis, like basically becoming like new ethnic groups.
Yeah. I mean, I guess like, you know, I think a lot of Christians are sometimes very triumphalist about the idea that they're going to like take over, but it's like, I don't know why they just assume that all of their kids are going to like hold to their political beliefs and their religious beliefs as adults. I mean, I think that society has a way of sort of like evening itself out. And I mean, the fact that like in any first past the post, you know, democracy, you're going to have like a 50-50 split. Like there's going to be some sort of like coded as left-wing impulse that like half of their kids are going to like go towards. Right. So that's one aspect of it. But I mean, I guess I would just say that, like, I mean, also, like, I don't know, like, in a world where you have all these, like again, like, super addictive, like, hypersaline dopamine traps, I mean, it doesn't matter. If you try to, like, raise your son to, like, never get addicted to porn, right? It's like, you have to, like, make sure he doesn't get, like, an iPhone. But in this day and age, that's going to, like, put him at a social disadvantage that, like, you have to, like, actually judge, okay, is it, like, actually worth getting him an iPhone and just sort of, like, rolling the dice just because he's going to be, like, a fucking weirdo if he doesn't have, like, you see what I mean? There's all those situations. And I don't think there's, like, a straightforwardly, like, good answer.
Is a society like America that has a lot of upward and downward mobility, do you see that as desirable, or do you see major problems with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that these days America has plenty of upward mobility. I think it's so easy to become rich. I mean, I was seeing a girl like last year who was making like 70, 80 grand a year, like fucking like walking dogs, right? I mean, you know, so I mean, it's not hard to become rich in America. Like, I think the problem is that America, it's easy to get distracted. So you get a lot of losers who just get distracted by shit all the time. But I digress. I guess my thing is I feel like being downwardly mobile in America is I mean, it's like the consequences are bad, like if you get into like the ghetto. But I don't understand how that happens. I mean, I know I have friends who are like losers, like layabouts who just like don't do anything all day. And like, I don't even think they're on like welfare, but they somehow manage to like pay their rent and like get by. I mean, like, I don't know if it's possible. Like, I don't know if America really does have the downward mobility anymore. I think in fact that we're so wealthy, we're so hyper affluent that it's causing a lot of like really weird social dynamics because people just don't have any pressure to like work or try at anything anymore. And then that's
kind of, it is the whole issue of like competition. It exacerbates competition over real estate. So then that gets into the whole like YIMBY versus NIMBY housing issue.
Sorry.
So I think a lot of people, maybe they feel poor because of their class, because of how, especially in California, because of how expensive housing is. So the more people that are rich, it devalues the value in being wealthy.
Oh yeah, I mean, I feel like California is its own thing. I mean,
yeah, I shouldn't be like I'm talking a lot of these things. Like I'm such a California centric. Like,
well, all Californians are California centric, right? All California. So no, I mean, yeah, I guess that is.
You have a California. You have all these people who are like upper middle class, even wealthy, who feel much poorer than they are because of how expensive real estate is.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially in like San Francisco, it's like very weird. I mean, like you'll have like guys who are making like $150 a year who are like poor because, you know, I mean, like they're just surrounded by all this, like all these like super wealthy tech bros, you know, at like, you know, these crazy like asymmetric return startups. Or I mean, like, yeah, I mean, it's a crazy fucking dynamic. And then, you know, you have all the like suburban sprawl, you know, caused by the NIMBY shit. Yeah, I mean, it's very much its own thing. But I mean, it's sort of inevitable. I mean, it's weird. I feel like you look at like America's geography, it's like California is so fertile, and then like all around it, you have all these like desert and mountain, right? And then it's like sort of inevitable that like create like this sort of like parochial sort of attitude. And I wonder if that sort of like plays into, you know, you think of someone like Nancy Pelosi, right? Like she's very like San Francisco. Like there's a certain like superciliousness to her, right? Of like she sniffs her own farts. Like she doesn't like recognize the rest of the world as existing.
It is really a bubble. We were talking about this, and I kind of cut you off, and we kind of moved on to another topic. But do you think if California, like, radically embraced YIMBY, do you think it could just, like, drain a lot of the rest of the nation, other population? Because yeah, how many people want to live near the coast?
No, yeah. I think what's-his-face, that BB Knives guy on Twitter was writing about this, right? Like, if they just, like, allowed – there would be, like, high-rises, like, right next to the beach, like – LA would have like 100 million people.
Oh, like Hong Kong kind of thing.
Yeah. No, it would look exactly. Yeah. It would be, but like you'd have like all these areas. Like, I mean, it would actually, I think to some extent, like NIMBY is sort of, maybe it's kind of a conspiratory thing, but like, I think to some extent, like if you're in like South Dakota or maybe not South Dakota, but like, cause they have the oil or whatever. If you're in like, or that's North Dakota, but if you're in like Wyoming, right? Like you don't want, them to allow that in like LA, right? Because like you need all these like productive, smart people in your own state, and they're just going to move, right? And then you'll just be left with nothing but like refuse. And you know, like I mean, that's already been a problem in the Midwest, so it's like they don't want to exacerbate that. So in a sense, like the NIMBY and like the California NIMBY is sort of like helping the rest of the nation.
Yeah, that's true. I think. Do you think California would? Well, California would still be pretty diverse, but do you think it would change demographically?
I think it would. I mean, I think it would still mostly be like very left leaning. It would be like young people who go there, right? Like people who are more artsy. I mean, it would be like the sort of people who go to Europe, I think. Yeah. I mean, I sort of get the idea because it's like no one's going to be going there for like cheap land right? I mean, I guess maybe if you just completely, you know, allow total like housing, maybe there would be
enough. NIMBY does create these selection pressures. So it selects for very specific people who need to be in California. So a lot of the population is aging, but it's rapidly aging, but it does select for people who are from like particular immigrant communities that are tied to California, or for people who need to be here to work in tech. But it selects the housing shortage, especially in the Bay Area, selects for very particular types of people.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That makes sense. Interesting.
You were posting on Substack posts that you think usury is actually a good thing for upward mobility.
Yeah. No, I mean, it objectively is, right? I mean, like, you know, like, if you don't have you need it for like liquidity, right? Otherwise people are just going to like hoard their money because they're not earning anything on it. But it facilitates class mobility. People can like take loans. I mean, to me, it's like obvious. Like, I don't know why people are like, if anything, you want more and more usury because that drives down the interest rate. If it's like an open market, right? Like you have people competing and it sort of like drives down the cost of lending. Whereas if you restrict usury, then you'll just have like some dude charging like 25% interest on like payday lending. You know, I mean, like it's obviously better to have as much usury as fucking possible. Like I'm all for usury. It's great. Like that's what enables us to like not live like caked in shit. Right. I mean, it's like the whole world is built on debt. And you have all these sophisticated financial instruments that all these chuds like hate, like derivatives or whatever. It's like the derivatives are what allow us to have a more predictable and stable economy. I mean, if you look at how many, if you look at like the 19th century, we had like a recession every other year, right? If you like, look at the chart, right? It was like the Federal Reserve. I mean, you know, it's going to piss off.
I mean, you were a Ron Paul guy, but so you're saying Ron Paul is basically wrong.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like, yeah, like he was right about like one of the past, what do people say? I'm too tired to remember the exact phraseology, but it was, I mean, it's like a broken clock is right twice. And like they all say he was like, right about the, Ron Paul was right about the recession.
I mean, if we were to end the Fed, we probably would have a depression overnight.
Well, yeah, we have one every year, right? Because you just have these constant like runs on the banks and these constant like crises. I mean, that's what happened in the, 1800s. It was a constant turmoil, and the Federal Reserve sort of stabilized things. Now, you also get like bigger if you don't have like a good monetary policy. If you have like a Fed chairman who fucks up, then you'll have like a bigger recession when you have the Fed than if you have a pure free market. But I mean, I think it's still better to have things mostly under control. And I mean, I guess just like generally speaking, it just like having access to credit is good. I mean, I hate this like anti-consumerist impulse you'll see in the right where it's like. Like people are like so like afraid of like, oh, you have credit card debt. Oh, you have a mortgage. It's all like you should pay everything in cash. And it's like such a fucking primitive like retard grudge mentality. I'm sorry. Just like, no, I mean like everyone is better off that we're able to like access things on credit. That it allows us to like have class mobility. And when you go into debt, it makes you work harder to pay off your debt. And like, yeah, people say it's bad, but like it does facilitate just a greater level of social vitality. It's like people want to have a better lifestyle. So they'll work harder to pay off their credit card debt.
Well, it's mostly people at the bottom of society who really get screwed over by debt. People in like the, not just the wealthy, but even a lot of middle class people are able to utilize debt. Well, I don't know. It depends. Like, it's a mixed bag for the middle class, but like more successful people are able to utilize debt.
I'm going to counter something. I'm going to say it's the lower middle class that's hurt the most by like credit card debt and stuff because I like poor people.
Well, yeah, the poor people just default. You're right.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's like they don't, it's a very middle class thing to like be afraid of like the debt collector. Right. And like you think you're going to get like sent to the principal's office of life if you like, you know, like it's funny. It's again, it's another U-shaped curve. Right. It's both the poor people and the rich people. Like Donald Trump doesn't pay his debts and neither does like Shaniqua. But like, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, they sure do. Right. And that's what the whole job stacking impulse is about. It's about like trying to get like middle class guys to be like piratey and to say like, no, fuck you. I'm going to act like Shaniqua and Donald Trump.
Right. Right. You wrote about immigration. You said that you think the United States should brain drain other countries.
I think I specifically said Russia and Ukraine, right?
Oh, is this just Russia or the whole world?
I don't know. I've said a lot of shit. I guess when it comes to I was making the argument that we should let in anybody from Russia or Ukraine who wants to come in, and it was sort of a cheeky thing where it's like I'm supporting open borders, but specifically because it's going to make the country more white, right? And
you wouldn't do that. Like some of the like neoliberals want to do it with China. You're not super going about that.
No, that's, I mean, the thing is like with China, it's not that dangerous though. Cause like what are the Chinese going to do? It's like the Chinese in America, they're not impressive. Like they're just kind of like beta, right? Like they don't like take
over. You wouldn't do it with India.
I know that my buddy, my buddy Sunshine is going to counter-signal me and say, like, oh, the head of NVIDIA's Taiwanese or whatever. I know he's thinking that, like, right now. No, but with India, India is scarier because Indians are sort of closer to us in terms of, like, their souls. Like, they sort of, like, can compete with us, right? They have more of that Faustian spirit. I use Faustian. And, like, I mean, that's why I got my arms around the Brahmin question. Like, that's why I was talking to all these Indians, because it's like, I need to understand what's going on here, you know? Because, you know, I was working adjacent to tech, and I was seeing, like, okay, this is going to be a thing, right? And I was right. I mean, it's already become a thing. And I think we just need to, like, make sure we, you know, handle it right.
Is there anything that we didn't touch upon that you'd like to talk about?
Honestly, I'm sure there, like, would have been, but I'm so tired that I'm, like, about to, like, collapse. So I'm going to have to range
it up.
Yeah, I'm sure we can talk again in the future. And then next time I'll interview you about some stuff. I know, you know, I was a narcissist. Like, you talk, you know, ask me questions this whole time. But we'll rectify that on the next time we talk.
Okay, great. Well, it was great speaking with you.
Yeah, it was great speaking with you as well, my chosen friend. Have a great rest of your day.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks.